The President's annual State of the Union message to Congress is one of the sacred rituals of our American democracy. On January 8th of the year 1790, General Washington delivered the first such report to the First Continental Congress. In it, he outlined some of the programs and policies which he felt to be necessary for the successful growth of the nascent young American Republic. And ever since that day, the President of the United States has used this occasion to outline those bits of legislation, those policies and programs which he feels should become part of the American way of life, and if enacted, will make for American well-being. This annual message serves also as a healthy reminder that the President, our chief executive, derives ultimately his authority from the people, and that he must make annual reports on his stewardship to them. The speech of last Thursday, in which Mr. Eisenhower made his report to the nation, also dealt mainly with concrete proposals for rectifying and improving our American body politic. His main concern was with improving the posture of our military defense. He felt, as we all do, that our missile program, our program of scientific and technological research, was behind schedule. And he developed 8 positive, concrete suggestions, which he felt, and which I am sure will, rectify and improve this situation. I would, however, call your attention to one of the most significant paragraphs in his speech, one in which he reminds us, quite opportunely, that preparedness alone, strength alone, will not solve the problems of peace. He spoke. There are 2 tasks confronting us. The first is to ensure our safety through strength. But we could make no more tragic mistake than merely to concentrate on military strength. For if we did only this, the future would hold nothing for the world but an age of terror. And so our second task is to do the constructive work of building a genuine peace. We must never become as preoccupied with our desire for building military strength that we neglect those areas of economic development, trade, diplomacy, education, ideas, and principles where the foundation of real peace must be laid. The tragedy of the President's message was that he did not go on from there and develop at length some concrete, definite, consistent proposals, constructive proposals, to bring about a situation of peace. We seem to be in a strange, anomalous position here in America. Our will is for peace, but we do not know the way. We acknowledge that peace can be achieved only through peaceful coexistence. We recognize that peaceful coexistence can be achieved only by sitting down at a table, by diplomatic conversations, by adjustments, and by bargaining processes. We are quite right in our feeling that we should bargain from strength. But unfortunately, we seem to be more concerned with building our strength than with bargaining. We have in the last several years not made a single concrete, forthright, and developed proposal which would enable us to move ahead towards a constructive program for peace. As a rabbi reviews the foreign policy of our nation of the last several years, he's reminded of the days in ancient Israel when King Zedekiah held the throne. Zedekiah lived some 2,500 years ago. He was an honest man, if a somewhat vacillating man. He was importuned in his policy by 2 definite and separate sets of advisors. Israel in that day was a small, somewhat insignificant state, which lived in the no man's land, a buffer zone between the two great world powers of that day, Egypt and Assyria, Babylonia. One of his groups of advisors, politicians, hard-headed statesmen, advised Zedekiah that peace, security for the small Judean state could be found only in military alliances, in military commitments to and pacts with one of the great powers or the other. They advised him to play power politics, to attempt to make hay for the small Judean state while the two great world powers raged at one another. Opposed to these statesmen were the prophets and teachers of Israel. Led by the prophet Jeremiah, they counseled the king that peace could be achieved only through peaceful means, that he ought to avoid all military entanglements, all military adventures, and that he ought to sit down and work out a truce, a compact, some convention with one of the great powers or the other, which would permit him and his state to live securely. Unfortunately, Zedekiah listened to his political advisors. He joined in an abortive revolt of the pro-Egyptian satellite states against Assyria, Babylonia, and he brought about only the ravaging of his country, the destruction of his capital, the enslavement of his people, and the end of the Jewish state. During this debate, the prophet Jeremiah was once moved sarcastically to vocalize a thought which has certainly been in the back of many of our minds. Speaking of those who advise peace through military adventure, through strength alone, speaking of those who have no concrete suggestions for achieving peace, he said, "They speak shalom, shalom, peace, peace will be the end result of our policies, ve'ein shalom, but there is no peace. There is no achievement of a truce. There is no betterment of the world situation." I was reminded a great deal of the teachings and the meaning of the life of Jeremiah as I read the president's message of last week. I was reminded of his teachings because of the fate of the Jewish people, which had not been willing to trust itself to embark on the adjustments and the diplomatic maneuvers necessary to achieve a constructive program of peace. But I was reminded primarily of Jeremiah because he dealt with one of the problems which confronted the Jewish state in those troubled days, a level of human behavior, of political problems with which our president and our country has not yet seen fit to grapple. Jeremiah was a profound student of human nature. And when he looked all about him at the Jewish people of that day, he was disturbed not only by their foreign policy, but by the whole character of the body politic. Instead of the ancient strict morality of Moses and the priests and the prophets, he saw about him a debased, a venal, a corrupt people, a people which had sunk from a high plateau of religious affirmation and moral living into the morass of a dog-eat-dog materialistic civilization. He saw about him a people which had forsaken ancient religious covenants and, moved by an urbane sophistication, came, it was true, still to the temple, but did not live by the principles which they mouthed within those sacred precincts. He saw about him, in other words, a people corrupt from within, and he recognized a truth of history, that a nation is more often destroyed from within by its own debasement, by the sapping of the vital, virile virtue and character of a people, than it is overthrown by forces from the outside. He was proven correct. And so, also, are there other examples of the correctness of his observation in history. We have only to think of the great empire of Rome. Rome, moved by the military courage, the strength of a Caesar, by the civic virtue and civic pride of a Cicero, by the moral integrity and moral fire of a Cato, the small Roman city-state, under great leaders, moved out and conquered the whole known world and brought peace and justice to that world. And then in the fourth and fifth centuries of this era, Rome fell before bands of forest and desert and nomad barbarians, Hun, Goth, Mongol, Vandal. When Attila, however, conquered Rome, and Alaric conquered the city itself, they conquered not the Rome of these ancient greats, but the Rome which was a shell, a feeble shadow of its former self, a Rome which had been debased by too much prosperity, a Rome whose patrician class had forgotten that noblesse oblige, that status means higher and more strict duty and obligation, and lived a life of indolence, a life of carelessness and carefreeness. A Rome brutalized and dehumanized by slavery. A Rome of bread and circuses, of sensual theaters and erotic literature and the violence of the gladiatorial games. A Rome which socially and economically and morally was corrupt, and being corrupt, had neither the will nor the strength nor the courage nor the vision to achieve deliverance from a few ill-clothed, ill-armed, and ill-horsed nomadic warriors that threatened the boundary. A Gaelic French priest of the 5th century, Salvian, wrote what is probably the most fit epitaph for this great civilization. He wrote in his history of his day, Rome morit et ridetur. Rome is dying, but it is laughing. All that is left of the grandeur of Rome is a neurotic giggle as they see the destruction of their whole civilization. What was true of Rome was true also of the great Spanish Empire of the Middle Ages, of the Byzantine Empire of the same day, and of the vast Manchu Empire of China. These nations grew old from within. They decayed, they rotted, before they were overthrown by outside enemies. They decayed because the virility, the virtue, the sense of purpose, the sense of the proper on which they had been built was no longer theirs. Their people were no longer willing or able to plan for their deliverance and to succeed with these plans. Now, I mention these observations of Jeremiah and of Salvian and of world history because, strangely, competent observers of the American scene have begun to speak of a corruption of character which never before was observed among our people. And I've begun to wonder whether all the money which we are spending on our defenses, all the programming which we are hopefully venturing for peace, may not itself be wasted and be futile unless this corruption of the body politic is stopped. We learn again to live uprightly, morally, and virilely. A competent, long-time columnist and writer, Mr. Walter Lippmann, in a nationally syndicated article this past week in Look magazine, spoke of the American people as fat, torpid, and indulgent. He wondered aloud where had gone the strict puritanical morality of our ancestors and the courage of our pioneer frontier forefathers. He wondered where had gone our sense of civic duty. We no longer really cared about voting, many of us. Most of us no longer gave of our time to civic affairs, as if we were in a stage of moral living. Each and every family unit, self-contained, buries itself in the ground for its own needs, its own problems, and concerns itself not one whit with the manifold stresses and strains which are disturbing the American scene as we move into the atomic age. And as might be imagined, Mr. Lippman was not sanguine as to the future of an America steeped in fatness, torpidity, and indolence. And he was joined in this observation by Mr. Max Lerner, famous for his biting political columns of the 30s and 40s, and now professor of American civilization at Brandeis University. Mr. Lerner has just completed a voluminous work in which he has tried to analyze the American civilization in mid-century. He has a great deal to say about our strength, about our achievements, but he also speaks of the Byzantine trend in American living. And by this he means a new trend toward self-indulgence, pleasure-seeking, hedonistic, a trend not concerned with civic duty, social virtue, personal morality, but a trend which is concerned only with the acquisition of new luxuries, new erotic experiences. He speaks of the breakdown of the family ties. He speaks of the spread of crimes of violence and of adult criminality and of juvenile delinquency. He speaks of the growing problems of alcoholism and drug addiction. He speaks of the fact that one out of every 10 Americans, adult Americans, will be sufficiently mentally ill during the course of their lifetimes to warrant hospitalization. He speaks of the fact that almost 50% of the first 2 million young American men who presented themselves in World War II for induction into the service were found to be physically or mentally unfit for that service. He speaks of a moral interregnum existing in America today. He feels that all the traditional moral obligations, the do's and the don'ts of the Ten Commandments, have been watered down, rationalized away, psychoanalyzed away, and have disappeared. And in their place, there is a moral chaos in which our young people grow in up by experimentation and by self-indulgence and do not always understand the way of strength as opposed to the way of weakness. And Mr. Lerner and Mr. Lippman are joined by the Professor Emeritus of the Department of Sociology at Harvard University, Dr. Petrim Sorokin, who just last year observed what he called the progressive sexualization of our American culture. He spoke of the facts that our mass media communications, the radio, the television, books, and the movies, have become one mass of erotica, of sensual literature. And he observed that creativity in America, virility in America, mental health in America, all that we hold precious and dear, has been undermined by a culture which is attuned to self-indulgence rather than to self-sacrifice. And these men were just yesterday joined by a column which many of you may have read in our Cleveland Pain Dealer by the columnist Mr. Philip Porter, in which he observed, and I should like to quote a bit, "A considerable lather is being stirred up these days about why we're not training our young in pure science, how we have lost our idealistic bearings and have gone for the fast buck, how a lot of kids get into trouble when too young, how others go on to college with only the thought of extending their adolescence. I believe that these worries are all related. Lately, I've read some startling news items which by themselves didn't seem so jolting, but when read together made me sit up and think and steam. For instance, in last Sunday's paper, Eugene Gilbert, the expert youth surveyor, reported that, first, nearly half the young people today believe that wiretapping is okay, and second, that one out of three believe a central government agency ought to censor movies, comic books, plays, radio, TV, and newspapers, even dress. In a recent issue of Editor and Publisher, a sampling of opinion from students at Purdue University revealed 83% approved wiretapping, 60% favored censorship, 58% saw no harm in the third degree, 50% were ready to dispense with the freedom of the press. 25% would grant police the right to search without warrant. 13% would restrict by law religious belief and worship. Gilbert also found in an article in Look magazine that young voters just turned 21 didn't know and didn't care whom they'd have voted for in the last presidential elections. Only 2 out of 5 said that they'd have bothered to have voted at all. Translated, this means that our younger generation, whom we are counting on to make this a better country, and among other things to ward off the Russian communist dictatorship, are in a mental mood where they've already accepted the principles and framework of dictatorship. Either they don't understand the freedoms on which this country was built 175 years ago, or they've already waived them. How come? And how come not enough kids are choosing a life of research or pure science? And how come there is a feeling that far too many gifted children are not educated up to their capacity, regardless of their economic status? I have a theory. It's because the parents haven't raised them with a sense of responsibility to the country and to the human race. The parents have lost their way. If the kids find theirs, it will be a miracle. Most kids, in spite of their typical bravado, want to succeed and want to have their parents proud of them. But how can they achieve this pride when the parents have none themselves? When they worship the dollar? When they do not emphasize in early age the sacrifices necessary to succeed in the arts, sciences, and professions? When they do not stimulate a thirst for knowledge? Right now, as a nation, we're just starting to think about this and how we got that way. We've worshiped power steering, the movie bosom, the pressure cooker, and the 21-inch screen instead of the PhD. Our sons and daughters might be learning by sweating 12 hours a night over a microscope, searching for some virus, the killing which someday may, the discovery which someday may prevent cancer. I have chosen these four reports because they come not from professional moralists, from the preachers and ministers of our land, but from hard-headed newspaper people, from analytic university professors who religiously and morally have no axe to grind, but who are profoundly shaken and disturbed by the materialistic, acquisitive, amoral nature of much of our present-day American civilization. And we must ask with them some sober and serious questions. What is the future of a country which in the 10 years between 1947 and 1957 spent nearly $500 billion on itself, on alcohol, on jewelry, on tobacco, on drugs, on recreation, and less than $58 billion on all of its educational programs, on all of its religious programs, on all of its social justice and social welfare programs, and all of its medical and scientific research. Less than 1/10 of the money with which we indulged ourselves was spent on programs to improve ourselves. What is the future of a country which is so lax as to its family ties and standards of sexual morality that 1 out of every 3 marriages contracted end in divorce? What is the future of a country where 12 million of the 47 million of young people below the age of 17 now live in homes which are either broken or controlled by others than both their parents? 1 out of every 4 children is today being raised in a broken home. What is the future of a country which has so indulged itself in erotic literature, shoot-em-up movies and television programs, that crimes of violence among our teenaged people have increased 1,000% in 10 years, and among our adult population 200% in the same period of time? What is the future of our country where the author of the Studs Lonergan trilogy, which so shocked our people 30 years ago, was moved to observe in a national magazine just last week that the delinquency shown by Studs Lonergan in the Chicago slums of his day seemed also almost sane, normal, and law-abiding behavior when compared with the sadism, the masochism, and the wanton destructiveness of juvenile gangsterism today. What is the future of a country where the standards of personal integrity have tended to be rubbed thin, so that it is not so much whether we abide by our own conscience, but whether we can get away with something, and if we get away with it, then even our neighbors seem to be proud of it. Now, I have overpainted the picture. I have done so purposely. I think it is time that we as Americans wake up and are shocked out of our moral indolence and become conspicuously, consciously, vitally, crucially aware of one basic fact, that unless we live by standards, by high standards of personal integrity, and commit these standards to our children, to our neighbors, to our community, and to our country, unless we learn to live as human beings rather than as highly sexualized and brutalized animals, the very democracy, the very way of life, the leisure, the standards of living which we are seeking to protect from Russian imperialism will decay from within more easily than they will be destroyed from without. All the billions upon billions of dollars which we are spending for national defense are not worth a single nickel unless, as a people, we have invested the time, the effort, the duty, the responsibility, the service to protect, to encourage, to extend the way of life and the standards of freedom, liberty, moral living, which we cherish. The prophet Jeremiah knew the answer, as he knew the question. He counseled the people of his day to develop a Brit Hadash, a new covenant between themselves and their God, a covenant in which each individual human being would promise God not that he would bring sacrifices to the temple, but that he would abide by the strict standards of the Ten Commandments, that in his personal life he would live by standards worthy of a servant of God, standards of justice, standards of mercy, standards of kindliness, standards of integrity, standards of generosity, that he would again remember that the blessings of living in a free nation imply the responsibilities of living as a divine human being. This is our responsibility. The age where of moral indifference, which has brought us only the tranquilizing pills, neurotic headaches, and a great deal of human unhappiness. The indifference of this age must be brought to an end. We must bring our personal lives to a fine peak of moral strength, and each of us in his own way must contribute creatively through his integrity, through his interest, and through his service to the growth and the extension of our American dream. Fortunately, America is not so sunk in its own weaknesses that this is altogether impossible. But the danger signs are there. We have not yet come to the point of no return. But I truly believe that each and every one of us must see to it that America never reaches that point. And that though some of us seem to think that we are near the meridian of our civilization, that the decay of our American dream may yet be at hand, that more of us will realize that we have not yet heard the cock crow or seen the morning star. That in America, peace with prosperity can yet breed a citizenry which is strong, filled with vision, virtue, and virility. Amen.